This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Watching films, we marvel at scenes like Luke Skywalker chasing stormtroopers through the Redwood Forest or a five-minute shootout in a scene of a bank robbery. But capturing action like that requires the artistry of a grip, a skilled technician who provides the camera and lighting support to make the shots possible. And that's the work that Chunky Hughes has been doing for more than 50 years. He started when he was a teenager in northern England and now runs Gypsy Grips, a grip company in Wilmington. He's worked on more than 100 films from Death on the Nile to Star Wars. And he joins me now from WHQR in Wilmington. Chunky Hughes, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me here.
It's great to have you. How did I do describing the job of a grip? It's more than that. Can you give us a kind of a bigger picture of what the grip does?
Well, basically, we call it a bell bondsman. We get everybody out of trouble. we rig all the sets. We put the lights up for everybody. We do all the backings. We take the walls out. We run the camera. We put the camera on cranes, on dollies, on car rigs. That's why I have such a large crew, because there is no... But any job that nobody wants is a grips job.
Well, that is a much better description. So let's start.
We draw the line at sweeping the floor.
I see. Well, and it is. I mean, so the director may have the imagination, but somebody's got to figure out how to get that crane up there. So I want you to take us back now to see how all this started. Let's start with your childhood. Tell us about the town you grew up in England.
I was born in 1940. And there was some mad German dropping bombs on me. I didn't even know who he was. I don't know why he was dropping bombs on me. And I was born in Shepperton, which is in South London. And the one thing we had there was a big film studios, which was actually the only place of work in our village. And I never thought for one minute that I'd ever follow my father and my uncles, my aunties, my mother and everybody into that business, because I thought, I don't understand it. But I did go in eventually when I was 18. I kept my rock and roll band right up till then. I was quite happy going out and playing blues and, And then I thought, well, now I've got a son. I better get a real job. So I went into the film studios at Shepperton Studios, and for 2 years I really didn't use my brain. I was told to get that, bring that over here, put this here, put that over there, go and empty this, But it was a wonderful education in those 2 years, because I got to watch what people did.
What kind of films were they doing in those studios back then when you were growing up? What kind of films were they doing out of those studios when you were a young child? Back in the days when you decided you were not going to be in the film industry?
We had the Guns of Navarone. Guns of Navarone, Oliver, all these... films that now are like icons at the time. I mean, when I started, we didn't even have coloured film. It was all black and white. And then when we started with the first colour, it was amazing, because we re-educated ourselves, because we needed more light and more, of my stuff, or my stuff that my equipment doesn't actually... it goes around the light and on the light. That's our job. We shape the light. The grip shaped the light.
And you talked about being in a rock and roll band. I don't think you were probably a member of the Dave Clark Six. Nobody remembers that band.
Oh, George remembers all this. We've already done a segment on that down here at WHQR. I started off at 14 with what we call a skiffle band, and then eventually we got better and better at what we did, and we were doing, venues. I was on the same circuit as a band that nobody knew then, but everybody knows them now. The Stones were in our stable. Yeah. There was a group called the High Numbers, who became The Who. But we never really met each other unless on the road. You know, we'd stop at, you know, cafes on the roads, and you go in there at 12 o'clock at night, it's just full of rock and roll bands, you know, coming home from gigs.
Along the way, you learned a fair bit about carpentry and design and engineering, kind of just picking up stuff from around.
Oh, watching, you know, yes. And then eventually there was a gentleman there who saw me one day out in the pouring rain, and he said, you know, what are you doing? I said, I'm on punishment duty, sir. And he said, why? I said, well, I must have said something to a charge hand or a supervisor, because, you know, when we pulled all the sets out, we took them to the back lot and made a big pile. And so when the snow was on the ground or it was raining, the bad boys were sent up there to pull all the nails out and everything and salvage all the timber, because they used it again. They used it again and again, save all the flats. And he said, that's crazy. Come in here. And I walked in with him, and he gave me a cup of tea, and he said, you're wasted. I said, yeah, I am. And about 4 weeks later, my head man came to me, and he said, you're off the gang, you know, which was our gang. And I said, oh, yeah, what am I doing? He said, you're going into the camera department.
Wow.
And I went, camera department? So I didn't realize that it was a camera department this gentleman ran. And I went in with two other guys, and we learned all about cameras, how they work, what they did. And in our lunch breaks, we, you know, got hold of dollies and practiced our skill. And then one day they said, you know, you're going over onto your gripping, you know, dolly grip on this show. And I went over, and I said to my father before I went on, I said, I'm gripping tomorrow. He said, put a tie on. We all had to wear ties on set. And he put a tie on, and I said, well, what do I do? He said, go on there and do anything you want. And I said, really? He said, yeah, and in 10 minutes, there'll be 50 people telling you what to do. And it worked that way. The camera operator, who the dolly grips work very hand in hand with, we've got to put that dolly into a position where he can get the shot he wants. We have to make sure we hit our marks for the camera assistant who's pulling focus all the time. And I said to him, excuse me, sir. He said, yes. I said, I'm your dolly grip. He said, oh, I'm very pleased to meet you. How are you? And I said, I've never done that before. I've never done this before. He said, don't worry. You'll be fine.
Well, so and, is that where the term comes from, grip? I mean, literally, like you have your hands on the dolly while the camera operator is worried about the focus and the other part of the shot. Is that kind of how that team works?
That could be part of it, but I think most of it, there's a lot of it. I think it really, really originated in the States because in the 30s and the 20s and things like that, nobody worked permanently for the studio. When the film finished, they were all out of work. And then they would put out a call, and these guys would turn up, and they had like a grip bag, you know, with their hammers and their wrenches and everything in it. And they said, we need a grip. Right, you're a grip. And it's because of that bag. That's what we've always believed. But the other thing is you know, there's a light or there's something that's a little bit unstable, even a tripod. And they turn around to the guys who were there and say, get underneath this and grip that, you know, so it wouldn't go over.
Because, I mean, you joked about the fact that you could do anything you want until they told you what to do. But the fact is the grip does have a lot of, especially a key grip, a lot of responsibility for figuring out not just pushing the thing into position, but how you're going to lock it into position, how you're going to get it there, and where that position is. I mean, there's a lot of technical knowledge, tactical knowledge that you have to bring to it where you really innovate and do the kind of ingenuity that is required to make that shot happen, right?
Yeah, when they line up a shot, I mean, we'll talk later about, you know, preparing for shots, which we have the time to do. But actually, when you're there, you've got to be an innovator. You've got to come out. You've got to pull a rabbit out of a top hat, you know, and you go, what have I got? What have I got? What have I got? I haven't got this. I haven't got that. Yes, we got that. I'll get that. Long as it works, and long as it's where they want it, They are very, very happy.
How much of your improvisational skill do you think came from the fact that you were working in those war years, or at least lived through those times in London where improvisation was the key to success, and you had it, and the fact that you were pulling nails out of boards and salvaging material like that?
Yes, yeah. It's an old saying that I've always said to people: if you go home after a day's work and you haven't been and you haven't learned anything, then you haven't been paying attention. And we paid attention. As the young ones, we paid attention because the older ones who were above us were very scared of us. They were very scared of this young blood, where I have never, ever been scared of young blood. Young blood is what keeps the wheels turning. Mm. Yeah, and yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, even to the point of, you know, at my dad's house, you know, building fences around his house or building a shed for him or something like that as a young teenager, it was all therapeutic and it stayed. Everything has to be in triangles. Always remember a triangle is it. Yes, I would say you're absolutely correct in that.
Well, you know what? When I get told I'm right, that's where I take my break because I've never heard it before on this show. And I thank you, Chunky Hughes. We're going to come back. Our conversation continues with Key Grip Chunky Hughes from Wilmington. You'll hear more of it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. More to come. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Okay, roll the credits. All right, Last of the Mohicans. Let's see, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, Madeline Stowe. Yeah. Oh, no, here we go. Still photographer Frank Connor, gaffer Danny Eccleston, and oh, there it is. Stop the film. Key Grip Chunky Hughes. He's my guest today on The State of Things. You will see his credit, his name at the end of many films, over 100 that he has done as a grip or a key grip in his career. He's been working more than 5 decades and today runs his own grip company based in Wilmington called Gypsy Grips. And before the break, Chunky, we're talking about your earliest days. You ended up working for Paramount Studios, is that right? And then and got to make a very big movie that we're all familiar with.
I did a Paramount thing, and I got so many movies. You've got more history than me. Can you tell me which big one we're talking about? Please?
I think it was Queen of the Nile.
Death on the Nile.
Death
on the Nile. Yeah. I'd already worked for Paramount. My first ever movie on my own, as an independent. Was in 1967, and I worked for Paramount on a movie called The Last Safari with Stuart Granger. Mm. Yeah, and well, that was my first one on my own.
You worked with some fairly big names, too, and I wonder what it's like. You worked with Frank Sinatra.
Yes, sir.
Toward the end of his film career, and that was kind of an interesting moment in his career. And I wonder if you'd talk about that relationship, because His reputation at that time had been kind of as a bad boy. He certainly was a pretty famous guy by 1967 when that film was made. And, you know, it seems like he was kind of trying to have his own way toward the end of his career. What's it like to work with somebody like that, a guy like Frank Sinatra, you know, who might have a reputation as being something of a diva on the set?
Yes, he was. But it's like, even till to modern day, we've got our bad boys, you know. But they never seem to interfere with the grip department, you know, because I got big boys work for me. And Sinatra on that, he was pretty bad to production and pretty bad to makeup and different people. But he always called me the kid. Where's the kid?
Wow.
I'm over here, sir. Hey, what are we doing? Where's this machine going to move to? From there to there to there, sir. Okay, got it. Let's do it. You ready, kid? And that's it. I was kid.
Wow, that's not bad. Because for most of your life, you only wanted people to call you Chunky. You have a given name, which we won't give away.
I do. No, thank you.
But you let Sinatra play.
I'll tell you
kid.
Personally after the show.
All right. We'll do that. What? And I know you've had other... I'm just trying to imagine this relationship between the grip and the director, because the director imagines the scene, right? It has to come out of their imagination, working with writers and everybody else. But the collaboration...
And we have to include the director of photography in that as well, because right. they work closely. Because if a director sees a scene in his head or how he wants to do it, the director of photography has to get involved in that, because if he wants to go 360, how do we light it? You know, so right. he will compromise with the director of photography or the cinematographer and leave him some space somewhere so he doesn't completely do a 360. And we do 360s nowadays, but what we've done, we've just flooded it so much with light from top light, and top light is not a very complimentary look.
No.
You know, you light their heads, not their faces.
Well, backlight is pretty troubling, too. We played that the theme from The Last of the Mohicans, that proved a challenge to you, that amazing scene where we're sort of burst through the waterfall, but that's a hard thing to shoot, right?
Well, it wasn't hard from the camera's point of view, because they were in. We actually had an entrance to a waterfall cave on DuPont land, and we shot the exterior of them all going in. And then we built the actual set in an old warehouse in Asheville. And the problem is that if you have rain... If you've got somebody standing in the rain and you see the raindrops falling on their coat or their hair, that's pretty good. But if you saw a whole street of rain, you don't see the rain on film. So what we have to do, we backlight rain. We backlight smoke. We backlight rain so that you get an idea. You go, oh, hello, it's raining, you know. But with that one... with the coordination of the grips and the construction and the special effects guys, they built the set and then put a big rolling trough on the top of the set, and a holding tank at one side and a holding tank at the other, but a big holding tank at the side where the waterfall came down. And so the water went over the top, dropped down in the rivulet, so it does, and they had the spaces in there, so it wasn't always perfect. But our problem was to backlight it, but not actually see lights.
Yeah, that's the problem. Backlight is not a friend of the camera. So
it's not a friend of the camera, no, unless it's far away.
Right.
So what we did, we took big 20 by 20 Griflons, and we... glued mylar. Mylar is a very reflective product. They use it in windshields, and we put that all on there, and we took them up in the air, and then we had I had two guys on each one, and so when the waterfall started, the lights were angled and shielded from the camera, which the grips do. We don't let any leak light come through. And then, as the water was coming, and they were actually rolling the camera, my guys would just stand there and shake it. Shake
you
it
literally
by, just
have people...
by hand.
Wow.
I mean, the simplest way is always the best
way. The simplest way is the best way to come up with an incredibly dramatic scene. So I want to talk more about your personal life through all of this, because you talked about...
I never had a personal life.
You did, too. You had five kids. That had to be some kind of personal life, and you had them kind of early in your career, didn't you?
Yeah, I was 17.
Oh.
That's why I had to go into the studio. I had a son. I had to have some responsibility. And this is just a personal thing, but... from my five kids, I now have 22 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren, and another one's going to be born in Christmas.
Those are some pretty special effects. Nice job.
That's not,
congratulations.
That's not bad, is it?
Congratulations.
Where did I find the time?
Where did you find the time? You were traveling all around the world. So here's a guy from a relatively small town south of London who was at one point tearing the nails out of boards and is now traveling all over the world, earning the respect of the studios. What kind of effect did that have on your personal life?
I had to go away. I had to go away to earn the money to support everything that I had at home. Most of the other guys in my era, who are all wonderful grips in their own right, they had children, but they didn't want to leave home. They put the family first, and unfortunately, I didn't. I decided, well, I want clothes on their backs, and I want food in their mouth, and I want them a good house to live in, and the only way I could do that was to go away. And in the course of going away, I started to meet all the American crews all over the world and American directors of photography, which served me in good stead eventually, because when I decided I wanted to come to America, all these guys were there for me.
But at home, that kind of an interesting thing happened. Your kids sometimes didn't know if you were coming or going if you had a suitcase in your hand, right?
No. I always used to come back, and I'd have two suitcases, and one suitcase was all full of goodies from wherever I'd been. You know, if I'd been in Germany or in Saudi Arabia or wherever I was, I'd bring them back things. And the first thing as I walked in the door, hello, Dad, and ripping the suitcase apart.
Sometimes the suitcase came first, then the hello, Dad.
And I came home very early one morning, and I opened the front door and I walked in, and my youngest son at the time, Malcolm, who is now a very prolific key grip in England, very big, he's walked out of the bathroom and he's looked at me, and I've got two big suitcases, and he turned and looked at me and said, hello, Dad. You're going away again? I've been gone 3 months. I've only just got home and he saw the suitcase.
Wasn't quite sure if you were coming or going.
No, it was. I look back on it now, and I was really a little bit selfish because I never saw him in a school play. Mm. I never watched him play soccer. I never watched him swim in galas or anything, you know. And I come home and, It was great because it was joyous, but I wasn't there, always there for them. You know, I was...
Well, how do they feel about it now? I mean, a couple of them have followed you into showbiz.
Yeah, the two of them are still in it, yeah. You know, one of my sons does all the construction for most of the Marvel movies that are made in England, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, Thor, and all that, you know, the Avengers, he does all that. And my other son is a key grip whose resume, I think mine's good. I mean, his is excellent.
Yeah. How does word get around when you talked about meeting crews from the United States and elsewhere? And so is there a kind of a small universe, a communications network that gets the word up to the studio, hey, you got to check out this guy?
I don't know even if at that stage that they would actually contact the studio. They might just say, this is the guy I'm thinking of using, and if he's available, I want him. And they say, well, just go ahead. Because, I mean, after time there, you forgive me, that people in administration didn't know what we did. I mean, there's still people in the film industry I've known forever who doesn't know what a grip does. They have no idea.
You have received some acclaim. There was one shot from the movie Le Mans with Steve McQueen,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that shot, because you achieved quite a bit of acclaim for that shot.
Well, the thing is that we never ever the grip, the key grips, the dolly grips, and the rigging grips, and all these people, we never used to get credits. And now you watch a movie, and the credits are longer than the film. But I went over to work for Steve McQueen on 24-hour race of Le Mans, and we brought in from America. We had it shipped. We had one of the best cranes in the world. I mean, everything else has changed now, but this crane was the greatest crane. It was made by a company in Los Angeles called Chapman Cranes, and it was a Titan, and it comes on a big truck. And the 24-hour race of Le Mans went only sort of like a quarter of the track is actually on private ground. All the rest is public roads. The Mulsanne Straight and the curbs and everything, they're public roads. So when the race is on, they put barriers up. Well, we turn up, and right after the race, we filmed the race, and then they wrote, we had 2 weeks prepping, or 3 weeks, while they wrote a script about the race. And Le Mans was completely cut off because they left all the barriers up for 7 months. We right. couldn't go into town. We couldn't go to town. We had to go to another town. As I say, you do get accolades now and again. They're very right. few, but you do get an accolade.
What was it?
We wanted this crane to be over the track of the inside the barrier, but over onto the racetrack as low as we could possibly get the camera. And then they were going to send the cars. Well, those cars are going so fast. You know, I thought, And we worked it out. Oh, we were going to do it. And so we were very low over the barrier. And you could hear them when they say, OK, start the cars. And you can hear them from about 10 miles away, the noise they make. And he wanted us to time it that we could stay as long as we possibly can without impeding anybody. And as they came towards, I had to throw the crane up in the air. And my French counterpart, caught the back end. You have to ease it in, ease it out. You don't have jerks. It's got to be absolutely smooth. And I was just one leg. I had one leg over the side of the barrier, and I've got the end of it. And it's big. It's a big thing. And it's perfectly balanced. And as they came, I waited and I waited and waited. I could see them. And eventually I saw them. I knew they were going to get to me in a certain amount of time. So I slowly raised it up. And it went up. And then the camera swung around and watched them go away. And when it was finished, McQueen, it was his money. It was all his money. He turned round and he said... To the crowd and everybody through the speaker, he said, "How about a big round of applause for the grips?" Wow. And they all stood up and applauded. And we went, I went, "What's that all about?" You know, nobody's ever said thank you to us, but they do now. Everybody knows that you know, a please and a thank you costs you nothing, and it means so much.
That's a thank you to Key Grip Chunky Hughes, who we're meeting today on The State of Things. He's in Wilmington, and he's got his own grip company called Gypsy Grips. You know, but you talked about guys like Steve McQueen, some people giving you your props at other times, and you said, you know, it was his money that did it. You talked about being on a set one time working with a director, you know, who believed it was his film, and you kind of stood up to that director. Tell us about that.
Yes. We were on big buses. We were... all heads of department were on the buses, and we were going from Los Angeles and going down. It was a movie called Showgirls, and a lovely, I say he's a friend, he's an acquaintance, and we got on very well. It's Paul Verhoeven, who is a director. And Paul liked to let go steam now and again, and nobody would answer him back. And we were on this bus, and we're on our way to Las Vegas and to Reno to check out all the stuff. And nobody ever talked to me. Nobody. All of you are against me. You do not want me to make this movie, and you are sabotaging my movie. And I thought, I've had enough of him. And I just stood up in the middle of the coach, and I walked down, and I said, "Excuse me, Governor, can I have a word?" And he said, "Yes, Chunky, what do you want?" I said, "This is not your movie, Governor. This is our movie. Do you think we're going to sabotage our own movie? Have you any idea what you're saying?" And he went, "At last, somebody speaks to me." and when I walked back, all the boys were looking at me. Some were smiling, but most were nodding, shaking their heads. I thought, "Oh, well, he'll be gone when we get back to LA. He'll be fired." But no.
Yeah.
No, he didn't. You know, Paul wasn't a bully. But he acted like a bully.
Well, and you stood up. But it does take a certain point. I suppose you have to be at a certain point in your career where you feel like you can do that, right?
Yes. But then you also have to accept the consequences, right, if they don't agree with what you've said. Or it's a long time. I tell my people, long before they were grips, they were men. And you can't be subservient to everybody. You must sometimes stay out and say, hey, Gov, look, this is dangerous. We can't do it this way. And what has happened here in the States and in England and everything now, there is such great safety control on everything. Because everybody believes that key grip and first assistant on any set are the safety officers.
Wow.
So there's another piece of equipment you have to carry on your back. Like somebody will come around and say, those cables round there, one of them's making a funny noise or something. And we'll get the boys to go and check it. We speak to the electric boys, say, go and check it. Go and check that box. And so actually, we actually police ourselves. We police ourselves now. We do have people who, you know, like the safety officers will come round, like in America, it's the fire marshal. If you're on a stage, it's the fire marshal.
So you're bail bondsman and a fire marshal and key grip.
Oh, Chunky, we're everything.
Chunky Hughes. We're going to continue this conversation, find out how you got to Wilmington and the future of the film industry in Wilmington now that the tax credits are gone. All of that when we return with our conversation with key grip Chunky Hughes in Wilmington. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Chunky Hughes, a grip who's worked on more than 100 film sets around the world, now owns his own grip company based in Wilmington called Gypsy Grips. How did you, what brought you to Wilmington, Chunky?
Dino De Laurentiis. I did a lot of movies in Europe with Dino De Laurentiis. When they moved here to build the studio, the one thing they didn't have was a crew base. So he brought over 20 Italians and 20 English guys, and the English guys were grips, electric, carpenters, plasterers, special effects, sound department and everything. And the Italians, you know, they are good at it, were the costume designers, set designers, and everything like that. And the idea was that every department would take two of these local people, and while we were filming, we would train them, you know. And so I was fortunate enough because the shipyard here had just closed, and I went and got all the welders and electricians and, you know, they're all very good, you know, workmen. And brought those in, and they all got moved around, and I ended up in my period here. I trained not just me, my crew as well. We trained 20 people, and 18 of them are still doing it.
Wow.
And 18 of them hold key positions in the movie industry in Wilmington.
Well, it's interesting, too, that De Laurentiis' idea was to bring in folks who experienced people, but to work with the local population in Wilmington to develop other workers. So he wasn't going to keep importing people, right?
No. Yeah. No, he wasn't. You know, it's expensive, you know, and it you know, we knew what we were doing. We knew, you know, the boys said, this place is magic. Don't cut our own throats. So I said, no, you've got to. This is what we're here for. This is what we've got to do. And when you said about Wilmington, I came here to do the first one I did here was the Year of the Dragon. And then we stayed, and our work permits were increased to do other movies, and then eventually there was a little lull and I went back to England, then I came back again, and I just love Wilmington. I thought it was like my little village. I mean, now I suppose it's Gotham, is it, or Metropolitan?
What were those villages? I'm trying to imagine that you started out, I think, in 85, and then you came back to live a little later, right?
Yeah, no, I started out in 58 were in the first studios, but
I mean in Wilmington.
Oh, in Wilmington, I came here. Yes, you're right. Yeah. I came here in. When was it?
Well, according to our research, you were here in 85. Yes. You can change that. Though,
85.
Your story.
I came in 85, and then I stayed till 86.
Yeah.
And then went. And then I went back because I had a Bond film to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then straight after the Bond, I did Willow. And then I went to South Africa, Red Scorpion, and met an American girl and got married. And so that was it. I was back here.
Back here? And tell us about those two communities, because you talked about an Italian community and, I guess, a British community. Did you all kind of live together? How did that work when you all moved to Wilmington?
Well, we were all put up. We were all on Carolina Beach, and we were like our own little community. Wins 1, Wins 2, Wins 3, Wins 4, you know, the big rental apartment there. Mm. And, do you know, I could get from Carolina Beach to North 23rd Street in 13 minutes.
Ooh, can't do that anymore.
It's about an hour now, I would think. 13 minutes. And there were no rental cars here. There were no rental cars. The only people who had rental cars were Rippy Cadillac. And they were just cars that had been traded in. They thought, oh, we can make some money on them and then sell them.
One of the interesting things about having the film industry there, too, I guess, in Wilmington, is that then there were a lot of films that were done all over the state. I mean, we talked about Last of the Mohicans up in Asheville and other states. You've been here to Durham doing some films as well.
And Winston-Salem, and, you know, up in Fontana. It doesn't just stay in Wilmington, you know. We go all over North Carolina. Well, I have, and lots of films do, you know. You want to do a period film, you know. You know, the best place for that is Winston-Salem.
Wow.
You know? You go there, all you got to do is just mask out the street lights and the road signs, and you've got 200 years ago.
Wow.
You know, we're filmmakers. We make films. You know, it's like, you know, we lie.
Yeah.
Say, no, like, this is 200 years old. Oh, yes, it is, but
what's this business like? What's this business like for women? Is this an easy business for women to get into?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. It really wasn't. I think there were very few. What I remember all my career is wardrobe, hair, makeup, script supervisor, a front office. There wasn't really anything on set heavy, you know, working on set. And that has changed very much. And I have a wonderful lady grip who's been with me 20 years now. And everybody thought I was mad. What are you, you know, she's a skinny little girl.
Well, you recruited her, right?
Yeah, no, she came to see me. She was a hairdresser. And she said, oh, I want to be a grip. I went, are you kidding me? And then I thought, no, let's try it. Let's try it. And we did. And she's still doing it. And she's doing like, I don't know. She's down in Georgia with all my equipment. You know, she's been there. She's made like 15 movies now, that's a wonderful thing. Nowadays I would say in our modern day there is a lot of room for ladies. There's a lot of room for ladies. It used to be very chauvinistic.
Yeah,
very chauvinistic.
Talk about setting up your own business, Gypsy Grips. You know, what kind of a business is it? How many people do you employ? And do you have to own your own equipment, or you just kind of rent it as you go along?
No, I bought it all.
Wow.
I bought everything. I owned a grip company in England called Grip House, and for one way or another, which I won't go into, that I lost it. I lost it. The big boys decided it's time to take it away from me and my partners. And that was a blow to me from the point of view that on every set you went, everything you saw was Grip House. And I just couldn't go onto sets anymore and see all this Grip House equipment, knowing I didn't own it. And so that was an incentive for me to take whatever I got out of Gypsy Grips for my pittance, anyway, And I sent the money straight to over to America because I already had money in America because I had a social security number from the first day I ever got here. I paid American tax. Nobody else did. Stupid. England was like 45. America was 8. So I brought in English sterling and turned it into... and then went to my lawyer and we formed Gypsy Grips, Inc. And in forming Gypsy Grips, Inc. and me being the president, then I had to, then they gave me a 10-year work permit.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fact, I guess, back in those early days with De Laurentiis and having those communities come from, as you said, England and Italy initially. In a sense, you had kind of your own INS officer either on the set or nearby, right?
No, it was in the studio. It was one small office. Yeah. It was the INS, and I never forget the lady's name. Her name was Jessica Rademacher. And so when I looked at my passport and said, oh, look, yeah, I've got to be out of here in 3 days. Look, this is running out. Because it only gave you the permit to work on the movie that you were on. Mm. But the thing was, what they didn't understand, and nobody else understands, if you sign a contract, like we always sign a contract, with the producers, in there is small print. Any other product that they've got going, they can take you off that and put you onto the other one.
So the key is to, yeah. So you keep moving from one project to another, is that it?
Yes. So I just go in the office and I say, look, you better book me a ticket. And they went, why? I said, but look, 3 days, I've got to be gone. And my work permit runs out. They said, well, we haven't finished the movie. And I said, but that's not my fault. I'm not staying here if I'm illegal. And they went, okay, well, take this. Go over to the INS office, see Jessica. And you walked in, you gave her your passport and your paper and the letter from the production saying that they needed to keep me on longer. And then 4 or 5 days later, I get my passport back, and it's been extended. Mm. And I thought, this is easy.
It makes things work pretty well. Things are moving well and when the industry is booming, but now the legislature has taken away the tax incentives, and so I guess things are changing down there in Wilmington, huh?
Yeah. They haven't really taken it away. They just haven't done anything about it. It will run out on... December 31st at midnight. Mm. And so they took absence and they won't be back till February. Well, everybody knows that anybody preparing for a film, they're 6 months ahead. So, they've shot themselves in the foot.
The failure to extend, do you think, has, and with no real clear indication about whether they would extend, what impact has it had? Have people already started leaving?
I haven't. I know of two. But once Sleepy Hollow is finished, and I think Sleepy Hollow is leaving, Under the Dome will go somewhere else as well. But I just wrote this down today, and I'm a poet and don't know it really, but I put here, the movies come and we get to play and get paid, and now they don't. They go away to Georgia, Louisiana, and all points south and west. Yeah, and you know, and if you look at read things like in LA, the reason that we have so many movies in the South, I mean, it's not Wilmington, it's Wilmywood, you know. We have so many movies because there was no incentives in LA, and what was there were very, very small. Well, I just watched the news the other day, and Jerry Brown, the governor, has just tripled their incentive. So it looks to me like everything would go back from where it started. They would start making movies back in L.A. Well, all the stages in L.A. are all full, you know.
Right.
Bones, Castle, all these series, NCIS, they're all in the big studios on stages, permanently built. So it's not the stages that are in, and it's not the actors that are in, but it's the crews.
Yeah.
Los Angeles, especially the Los Angeles crews, there's people there haven't worked for such a long time. But this will change it. This will change it. And if it changes and it goes back, it won't come back.
Well, what about you, Gypsy Grip? You've been there for more than 20 years. You're going to stay?
Of course. Yeah. I'm not leaving Wilmington. It took me a long time to get here.
But I think you point to something pretty interesting, too. This is not just, you know, not just the sets and the actors. It's all, I mean, we've been talking about Grips, but there are a lot of allied industries that grow up to support a film industry.
They're all around us. They're all around us. All these industries that we rent from. The antique shops, you know, the set dressers go to all these antique stores and furniture stores and rent furniture from them to dress the sets. Mm. And then when they finish, they go back to the antique stores. And I don't think anybody realises how much money goes into the actual area of Wilmington and all around. And I can understand people that live far north in North Carolina and say, well, it doesn't concern us because we don't get them here, you know.
Yeah, but they do, don't you? Doesn't the film industry draw tourists, and then you've got scouts who are going to Asheville and they're going to Winston and they're coming to Durham.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
So
and employ local people, you know. I think the worst thing for me is it's the end of the era. It's the end of Wilmington, and it's the end of the town. Not the town. The town will always be okay, but it won't have all these tourists and it won't have people going around. Where did they film this? Where did they film that? Let's do a studio tour. Let's do this. Let's do that. Right. And they're coming in busloads. Right. And it's every mum and pop store. It's every coffee shop. It's every spa. It's every car rental. It's everything. It just goes.
Yeah, and certainly
it's like a big puddle of water. It spreads.
Right. And certainly there's a lot to see and do and a lot to draw tourists to Wilmington with or without the film industry. But still, if you lose it, you're losing something, right? I mean, something that you you are diminished, if not destroyed.
I feel sad for Wilmington. I feel really sad for Wilmington because Wilmington is a wonderful film town. This town has supported us forever. You want to go and film on Front Street? No problem. We'll close it. You know, it's just we have a wonderful rapport with our councillors and everybody, and we're all friends. Mm. We're all friends, and I think the bit I'm going to miss more than anything is not seeing trucks going down the road with the film equipment and. That's one thing, but what I'm going to miss is I'm going to miss all my friends. I mean, 4,000 or 5,000 people out of work.
Well, Chunky, I hope things turn around, and I certainly appreciate your hard work.
And I'm sure they will.
Thanks for talking with us, Chunky.
And thank you for having me. Thank you very much, and go in peace.
Chunky Hughes, a Grip. He's been working in the film industry for more than 5 decades, worked with the likes of Frank Sinatra, Arnold Schwarzenegger, joining us from WHQR in Wilmington. And he heads his own company now called Gypsy Grip in Wilmington. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our news director is Brent Wolf. And North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.